This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Rickster.
100%.
Come on, playwright.
5%.
I'm going with the answer. What the answer should be if the world made a lot of sense.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the only man in education that liked bad teacher, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing, bud?
I'm good. How are you?
I feel good. I'm good.
You loved that movie.
I dug them. You know, let me be clear. I completely understand. I took my team to see it, and some, including, Daniel Lotzenheiser, who, you know, is a straight-laced dude, pointed out that the movie has some dubious calls when it comes to taste and profanity and stuff. And B, the movie doesn't go nearly as hard on the satirical possibilities as it could.
Mm-hmm.
But given that all of these movies are such mawkish, sentimental tripe,
yep,
to actually have somebody go to the schoolhouse and go hard and go dark and go funny, mm-hmm, was such a breath of fresh air that I dug it.
So before we speculated whether this would be as good as Fast Times at Ridgemont High, did it make it into that class?
No, not as good as Fast Times, not as good as Dazed and Confused.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I mean, much more willing to pick fights with archetypes in either of those movies.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Very good. By the way, I did hear from some of your staff that perhaps it was a little bit of an uncomfortable experience to go see a movie with all that, you know, profane sex with your boss.
Yeah, well, we didn't know at the time how it was going to play out. It may have, you know, what are you going to do?
What do you mean you didn't know how it was going to play out? Did you not see the trailers?
No, I hadn't seen the trailers.
Oh, okay.
But
well, never mind. All right. There you go. All right. Well, it's summer, but we still have plenty to talk about here in the show. We will play Pardon the Gadfly. We'll hear Amber's Research Minute. And we will introduce a new segment for the summer, Chris Tassoni's Dollars and Cents. So let's get started playing Pardon the Gadfly. Intern Josh, let's get started.
Thanks, Mike. So, guys, New Jersey pension reform. How big a deal is this?
So, Rick, big deal, right? Chris Christie gets much of the Democratic leadership in New Jersey on board with his plan to basically ask teachers and other public employees to pick up a much greater share of their pension contributions and their health care benefit contributions.
Absolutely.
So why is this a big deal? Is this education reform or is this a sideshow? What is this?
This is absolutely education reform. You know, right? Every dollar that you're pumping into benefits, healthcare, retirement, is a dollar you can't spend on the classroom. I mean, this frees up more dollars for kids in schools in New Jersey than probably just about anything else that, you know, you've seen in the last decade.
Well, devil's advocate here. Other side would say, hey, you know, he's saving all this money so he can give tax cuts to the rich. You know, that if we just raise taxes more, we could do both. We could maintain these promises we've made to educators and have money in the classroom.
Well, I think the reality is that you know, mostly these are cuts that won't be made, these are cuts that aren't going to be made elsewhere in the education budget or somewhere else. But regardless, yeah, there's any conversation about budgets and spending, one argument is always that we can simply, you know, always claim more dollars from taxpayers. If people think that that's the way to resolve these debates, then it's free country.
Now, there is a concern that if you ask teachers, for example, to pay more for their pensions and their benefits, you're lowering their take-home pay, in effect. So what we've done is we've decreased the teacher salaries in New Jersey and done it kind of across the board, and you know, so good teachers and bad teachers. It's not a terribly sensitive policy in that way.
I mean, this is, you know, this is what that lawsuit's about in Florida, is teachers suing to argue that this is actually, problematic. We'll be curious to see how this plays out in Jersey, if there's any, you know, legal action. Two, sure. I mean, this is an argument for actually moving from defined benefit plans to something more like a 401k or 403b. Of course, the same people who are complaining about, you know, the fact that teachers are now being asked to make a somewhat more larger contribution are the same people who throw in a fit when people suggest that you move teachers off from defined benefit to defined contribution.
You know, what I think is most impressive is that they didn't just stick it to the new teachers or the yet-to-be-hired teachers. As some other states have said, well, the newbies that come along next year, we'll start asking them to pay much more, basically giving them a pay cut, but we're going to sit on our nest egg, just to transfer wealth from the young to the baby boomers yet again, as we do in so many areas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm mad about it, Rick.
You look mad about it.
The worst part about it, the whole thing, is the retirement health insurance stuff, which I'm only starting to begin to understand. But this idea in education that, you know, somebody can retire in their early to mid-50s and then have basically, in most cases, free health care for them, for themselves and their family until they hit Medicare at 65. And in some cases, even after they hit Medicare mm-hmm. at 65. And you say, it is hugely expensive mm-hmm. and going through the roof. And you say, what benefit is this providing to kids today in the classroom?
It's for the kids.
It's for the kids.
And Mike, you know, if you have a problem with those costs, you could always raise taxes on working adults.
Well, we've made promises. And by the way, teachers have gotten low salaries all these years so that they could get these retirement benefits.
Well, so go out there and push for those tax increases, baby.
All right. Topic number two.
We're at the end of the state legislative season, and not one state has pulled out of Common Core. What happened to the backlash?
So, Rick, I think this is pretty interesting. Granted, the race to the top winners, there were, 13 of them, can't pull out of Common Core because they've promised to participate. There's a handful of more states that are hoping to get the little drips and drabs of race to the top money that's still to be given out. So, okay, say that's 20. You still have at least, say, 25 states that have no federal incentive to stay in Common Core, are free at any time to say, you know what, forget it, we have buyer's remorse. You've got most of those states, huge Republican majorities that have pushed through breakthrough laws on vouchers, collective bargaining, pensions, everything else.
Not in most of those states, in some of those states.
All right, some of those states, right. Yet, I haven't seen any action.
I think that's right. I mean, I think this is what's interesting about the Common Core fight. You know, at the elite level, with the Jeb Bushes, with the Tony Bennetts, with the Chris Cerfs, I think you see strong support for the Common Core among prominent Republican and conservative figures. They argue that, you know, that this is good for schools, that it makes it possible to hold them accountable, that it opens doors for entrepreneurs because you've got a level playing field. And, you know, you've got momentum on this side, right? You've got Gates Foundation is investing in these efforts. You got the rest. Well, what's interesting, on the other hand, you've got this, you know, brewing kind of pushback, particularly on kind of some of the Tea Party listservs, in which Common Core is being seen not as an educational innovation, but as one more part of the Obama litany, you know, stimulus, Dodd-Frank, healthcare reform. And they see this as one more effort by the Obama. And what's going to matter is over the next 6 or 12 months, as we watch Michelle Bachmann run in Iowa, as we see Rick Perry potentially get in the race, whether or not that kind of pushback boils over into something that's bigger and that really starts to hit some of these legislatures, or whether it is just, you know, a tempest in a teapot.
Well, that will tell. But so far, it does seem like, look, I've been worried about a backlash. It still might happen. You certainly hear some conservative pushback, but it's interesting that it did not translate into any movement at the state house. I think a couple bills were introduced. I don't know if any of them were passed.
See, I don't think it would have happened this quick, though. I mean, you really only saw the pushback, you know, the counter manifesto came out maybe in, what, April?
Right.
May. I mean, late in the sessions. I think the real question, you know, you did see Texas pull out of the Council of Chief State School Officers just last week. I think the real question is going to be, you know, over the next 6-8 months, do you see pressure building up in some of these states, mm-hmm. Indiana, Michigan, what have you, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, where you really start to see pressure on this or not?
Okay, topic number three.
The Supreme Court ruled that California overstepped when it banned the sale of violent video games to minors. Was that the right call?
You know what? This is one where I'm deeply conflicted. I think at the end of the day, I'm with the court on this. I think I think the Scalia decision makes sense as part of a historic arc of decisions in which they've upheld kids' free speech rights across a number of media platforms.
Right. So they say, well, you know, we have not banned the sale of violent books to kids or violent movies. So
or
video
CDs.
Games or CDs,
or...
right. See, I'd take a different approach. Clarence Thomas, I think, on this one has it right. He's been consistent on this point in other free speech cases, saying, what are you talking about? Minors don't have free speech rights. They're minors. And I'm with them on that. I mean, to me, that makes a lot of sense that the Supreme Court got it wrong back in 68 with Tinker, back in the Vietnam War era days when some kids wore armbands to school and got kicked out. I just don't understand. I don't think there's any precedent to think that the founders envisioned that minors would have free speech rights at all.
And, well, I don't know. I mean, there were minors fighting in the, you know, I mean, there were minors at Valley Forge packing, you know, rifles and fighting. You think they meant for them not to express their...
Yeah, I mean, you look in the Constitution, I think, you know, there's language, right, about adults.
I mean, are minors entitled to, you know, protections, double jeopardy, freedom of assembly? I mean, which, you know, jury trial? Which of these freedoms don't apply to minors?
So I think on the free speech one, that the government, if it wants to, can delegate rights to minors. Otherwise, I think Clarence Thomas is right that, you know, these basically rights belong with their parents, and the parents can decide whether to delegate these rights or not. So, I mean, I think that that's especially in a school setting, I think it's been dangerous, this whole idea that kids have these free speech rights that, you know, can just creates a mess in school law and what, you know, undercuts school authority to create, you know, positive school culture. But more broadly, yeah, look, I see your point, Rick. I see your point. But I could go and quote the Clarence Thomas decision, but I won't. But I think it makes a lot of sense that this whole line of reasoning that we've had now for 40 years is getting us to a place that's kind of ridiculous. And at what point do kids, you know, maybe 17-year-olds have rights, but, you know, do 5-year-olds have these free speech rights?
Well, you know, that was one of the criticisms of Scalia's decision, that, right, the California law didn't even try to scaffold this stuff by age, right? They were treating everybody under 18 identically. Look, I'm actually with you on the schoolhouse. I think that, you know, the school is an institution. Different rules ought to apply because, you know, the state is in loco in parentis during that during that period. But you know what? I mean, one way to argue about this is actually, if you allow the state of California to outlaw these sales, that you're actually restricting parental rights. Those parents who judge that their kids are capable of doing this, to give the kids permission to go buy it, aren't permitted. Actually, that's not right, because that's right. Parents were able to, right, allow them. So, I mean, I think it's confusing. But at the end of the day, I mean, it seems to me that if you're not going to regulate music, you're not going to regulate books, you're not going to regulate movies, it seems awkward to me that you're going to have a different standard for video games.
Okay, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Josh, for joining us. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. Have you seen Bad Teacher yet?
Not seen it. Not sure if I'm going to see it.
Really?
Amber was a good teacher.
The trailer just seemed a little crass. I don't know.
Yes, of course it's crass.
Was it funny? I mean, did you laugh a lot?
Yeah, I did.
All right.
I don't know if Amber
was.
Was
your staff laughing?
I don't know.
Or were they cringing?
It's movie theater. It's hard to know in movie theater. It's probably part of each, I would think.
Yeah.
It probably depends on the individual in question.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to see her do a serious, dramatic role. You know? I mean, to see if she can really act this Cameron Diaz.
She did. There's Something About Mary.
Yeah, that was real serious and dramatic.
So, Amber, what you got for us today?
I have a new survey out by the Center on Education Policy, rather, not American Policy, administered to school superintendents and other district administrators. Had a decent response rate. I always look for that at 50%. It's asking district personnel about budget cuts and their implications. Last time I bored you guys to tears with survey results, so we're going to play a little 5-question game today. You ready?
Yes.
All right. Winner buys me my next Starbucks chai latte. Okay. Number one, what percentage of school districts reported cutting teaching staff in 2010, 2011 to curb cost? Mike?
20%.
Rick?
100%.
So, come on. 76%. Who's keeping
I was
score?
Closer.
Josh,
right,
you keeping
Rick
score?
Rick got that one. Yep.
All right. All right. Number two, by contrast, how many districts reported reducing staff benefits? Rickster?
100%.
Come on, playwright.
5%.
I'm going with the answer. What the answer should be if the world made a lot of sense.
You say 5. You say 100. We're not on the prices right here. 23%.
I was closer. I get
if
that
we
one.
Were on the prices right, I'd want to keep it low because it's whoever's closest without.
Yeah, you're
over.
Right. You're yeah. right. I had that backwards. Number three, in terms of reductions in non-staffing areas, in which area do you think that most districts reported cuts? Would you say, listen carefully, instructional time, extracurricular activities, PD, or facilities maintenance? Rickster.
Maintenance.
Mike?
PD.
PD is the correct answer.
Yes.
That
Boom.
Would be 56% of districts reporting.
That's telling.
Question number four.
I don't think it's useful either.
Yeah. Number four, to which area did most districts direct their Title I stimulus dollars? Would you say new instructional hardware and software, PD, or saving and creating jobs? Mike.
Saving and creating jobs.
Ooh, I got to go with Mike on that one.
You both are wrong. You
wow.
gonna believe that? New instructional hardware and software came in at 82%.
Wow.
Nuts.
Well, I think some of the guidance from the department encouraged them to spend that
That's
money, right?
That's what they said.
Wisely and well. They're sure. getting retooled for the 21st century, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Saving, creating jobs, 69%, by the way. Last, and I'm not, you're keeping score over here? Okay. Last, comparatively speaking, now how many districts do you think reported using stimulus dollars to implement strategies such as incentive programs to attract effective teachers and principals to high need schools? Using incentives. Rick, what are you going to say?
100%.
12%.
10%.
Yes. Nice.
That brings
pretty
me the
close.
Victory.
Who won?
That means you
got to
buy her the Starbucks.
Yeah, I was ignoring that part. All right. We'll put it on the Fordham credit card.
At least this is not a question, but this is my closing statement. The least surprising finding of all, Rick, how many districts do you think said they were really better off having received those stimulus funds?
100%.
That would be 90%. So pretty darn close.
I want to know who the other 10%
are. Hold on, Mike. How many do you think said they just didn't know whether they were better off or not with those stimulus funds?
10%.
Be 7. The 3% said they're worse off. So.
Wow. I want to meet those.
They're visionary. I think they see.
Anyway, interesting stuff, I got to tell you. You got to kind of pluck through it all, but there's some interesting stuff.
That's fun.
Oh, wow. Spend a palooza there, huh?
Yes.
I mean, there was all this pressure. I'll be interested to know on the IDEA side, too, because that was completely confusing. This huge influx of special
ed
money.
Saved, I read it, special education teacher jobs was what that went to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They saved them for a year or two, and now they're cutting them.
Right.
Yeah. Beautiful. Love it.
Think how much better those kids are because those people got held onto it for a year or two.
Yep. Love it.
I know.
Love it.
Sad,
all right,
sad.
Thank you, Amber. So
sure.
What song goes along
so
with this
since
one?
These districts took the stimulus money and ran. We have Take the Money and Run by the Steve Miller Band.
Yes.
Good stuff.
This is a story about Billy Joe and Bobby Sue. Two young lovers with nothing better to do. They'd sit around the house, get high and watch a tube. And here's what happened when they decided to cut loose. Headed down to Buell, El Paso. I swear they ran into a great big hassle. Billy Joe shot a man while robbing his castle. Bobby Sue took the money and run.
So, Rick, did you ever see the Steve Miller Band live?
I never did.
Never?
Never.
Really? I saw them a couple times.
Did you really?
Including in Ann Arbor. And the thing I want you to know about me in Ann Arbor was that I 4 years in Michigan, never once did I smoke pot. Never once.
Wow.
No, I hardly even saw it. I mean, I don't know. I'm one of these guys that's oblivious to
these
things.
At a Steve Miller show.
I remember thinking that something seemed awfully smoky, and I thought that maybe it was just the smoke machine.
Closest I came was we saw probably to that was probably we saw the reformulated Allman Brothers.
But
never saw Steve Miller.
You're missing out.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well now it's time for a new segment, Chris DeSoni's Dollars and Cents.
This is Dollars and Cents, where we make sense of education finance.
How much would you say it costs to train and develop a top-notch teacher for a low-income school? $50,000? $100,000? In Illinois, the answer is a whopping $400,000. The state spent a cool $43 million on its Grow Your Own Teachers program, designed to attract parents and community members to go back to college and become teachers. Despite hoping to attract 1,000 new teachers to hard-to-staff schools by paying their tuition and childcare costs while they were in training, just 17 people have graduated from the program and actually become teachers. At $400,000 per, Illinois could have attracted teachers just as well by giving out free Maseratis or sending low-income parents to Harvard and still have saved millions of bucks. It's also not clear there were ever going to be enough jobs for this legion of new teachers anyway. Several of the program's 17 graduates couldn't find jobs in Illinois. In recent years, districts have been laying off new teachers under seniority-based rules, and some of these pricey teachers are now across the river working in Missouri. I'm sure the Show Me State's taxpayers appreciate Illinois' largesse, but legislators could have spent their cash and political capital much more effectively by addressing root causes of their school's dysfunction. And next time, Illinois, think about unit costs. Instead of laying out millions and hoping the project works, find an existing high-impact program with a low cost per new teacher and simply expand it. Parents and taxpayers alike will thank you.
That was good stuff, man.
I know, pretty compelling.
That's intense. 400 Gs.
So what's the theory of action behind these Grow Your Own? Is this all about rural areas where we figure there's no way you're going to get most college-educated kids from the suburbs or, you know, cities to go out to some podunk place, and so we got to get local talent developed?
I don't know. What's the theory of action behind the Bridge to Nowhere? You know, legislators like to launch programs. Educators like stuff with fancy names. It's likable. It's swell. It's only $6-7 million of other people's money.
Right. But do you think there's some, you know, but don't you think there is some validity to this issue? Like, if we have found in Ohio, like in Dayton, for example, where it's going to be hard to attract the same kind of people that a Washington, D.C. or New York City can attract. You've got these coastal cities that talk about these big breakthrough reforms, especially around human capital. And you say, I don't see how it's going to work in Dayton, you know, or Lima, Ohio, or Cleveland, or some of these other places where it's just really hard to get recent college grads to come. So you start saying, well, we've got to get people who were from there, who have family there, are going to stay there, and get them to be effective teachers. That makes some sense, right?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. But I got to say, rather than kind of vaguely casting a net over the entirety of the state and hoping that, you know, I guess 17 people eventually percolated up, and it sounds like they weren't all that anchored since some of them moved to Missouri to teach anyway.
Right.
But, you know, actually using existing networks and getting those, and bringing, importing programs, I don't know, virtual programs that can actually do this work reasonably well, seems a hell of a lot. I mean, the startup cost of doing this?
Yeah.
$6-7 million to get 17 people through? I mean, it's just insane.
It's insane. All right. Thank you, Chris, for that excellent episode. We'll look forward to more of these as the summer goes on. That is all the time we have for this week. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.